Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
Across the street from where we lived was Walken's Bakery. That's Christopher Walken's family.
That's awesome.
I was 14 and I lied. I went in there because I wanted a weekend job. And I told them I was 16 and I was always a big girl. And they took me on and I worked for, 4 or 5 years in the Walken's Bakery with Christopher Walken, and we're still friends.
This week, our guest is the incomparable chef, restaurateur, entrepreneur, author. I don't know what else to say about you, Lydia Bastianich. Lydia has spent her entire adult life introducing Americans to the joys of the Italian table. She did it with one of the nation's first Northern Italian restaurants, Falidia, still going strong at the age of 35. She's done it with the Italian food emporium, Italy, of which there are now 3 operating in the U.S. with more to come in Las Vegas, Boston, Los Angeles, Toronto, and there's one in São Paulo, Brazil. Who knew? She's done it with her Emmy Award-winning cooking shows on PBS and her best-selling books, 14 and Counting. And perhaps most amazingly, she has accomplished this after coming to America as a 12-year-old refugee in pretty scary circumstances. Welcome to Special Sauce, Lydia. It is so great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Ed.
You know, we've known each other for so long, and I've been looking forward to this because you have such an amazing story, and you don't harp on it. You just keep on doing stuff. You've never let on to really how difficult the circumstances were in your coming here.
Well, Ed, you know, I am blessed. You know, I'm at a good point now. I have a great family, healthy grandchildren. I was given this great opportunity to come to America, to become American. I have my freedom, you know, the freedom of religion. And these were things that we were looking for, you know, when where I was born became part of communist Yugoslavia.
Right.
And to finally end up and be free and be able to express yourself, what is there to harp on?
I see. Well, let's talk about that background. So you grew up in Istria. Tell us about Istria.
Okay, so Italy has 20 regions. And in effect, you're looking at Italy, the boot, in the right hand, all the way up north of Venice, is Friuli Venezia Giulia. And now it borders with Slovenia to the east, and to the north, it's Austria. But there's a little peninsula now that is on the other side of the Italian border, and now it's part of Croatia. It's called Istria. Before World War II, Italy extended well into Istria and part of Dalmatia. So World War II, Italy lost, the war was on the losing side, and, as the spoils of war, that part, Istria and part of Dalmatia, was given to the newly formed communist Yugoslavia under Tito.
Right, under Tito.
Under Tito.
And so Istria has been a political football for hundreds of years, right?
It certainly has. We were under the Austrian-Hungarian. We were under the Croats at some point, back into Italy, the Venetians.
Even the Germans, the Hungarians,
French,
right?
The French, everybody kind of from. It's one of the borders situation, which reminds me so much of what's happening today and people fleeing and immigrant. I was, you know, part of that exodus.
You were a refugee. And so talk to us about what happened to your family.
Well, we got caught behind. So Istria, being on the border, is ethnically mixed. But it was a big part was ethnic Italian. And we were part of the ethnic Italian group. But when we got caught, because I was just born in that period, you know, the war ended in 45, 46. By the time everything took 2 years, 47, I was born in 47. So we just got caught behind it. But by that time, 250,000 ethnic Italians escaped or went back from Istria in that area back into Italy and into the world. But I was born, my mother and my father, where were they going to go with you know, me just being born? They stay there. The Iron Curtain went up, and it was, you know, a strong Iron Curtain. Tito initially was strong. He wouldn't allow
Tito any. Tito was not a chill dude.
No, in the beginning especially. Then he loosened up a little bit. But after 2 years, and it was in 56, my father and mother decided that this was no way to continue because, you know, we couldn't speak Italian, couldn't go to church, couldn't do any of those things. They decided that somehow they're going to escape back to Italy. But they wouldn't allow the whole family to go. So my mother, my brother, and I, and we had relatives on the other side of the border. And my parents, my mother decided that we are going to go first, the children and the mom and my mother. We sort of, my aunt was ill. That was the
reason.
That was
the excuse.
That was the excuse. And we went. And two weeks later, my father literally escaped.
They thought if they let him go, then there was no way you were coming back. Then that was their way of guaranteeing.
He was held as a hostage. But he escaped.
He escaped like in a hail of bullets, right?
Exactly, with dogs running after him and the border. And he made it into Italy. And that's where we were reunited. We were with the family and, you know, living with the family part of the time. And it was hard, difficult to find a job. Ultimately, my parents decided maybe it's best that we move on into the world because Italy in the aftermath of the war was difficult.
And you were living in a refugee camp.
To do that, we had to enter a refugee camp, a political refugee camp, and wait our turn for possible visas, you know, to countries. So at the time, of course, America was number one. Canada was accepting. Australia was accepting. But we were lucky enough. In 1958, we finally got the visa. Dwight Eisenhower was the president. That we can come as a family in the States.
Wow.
And so it was very exciting. You know, 2 years in the camp, you say, okay, Lydia, yeah, I was in line for food with my little plate and whatever. But, you know, it's I don't regret because the finish is a good finish. we came here. We had nobody here. We had the Catholic Relief Services bring us here, find a home for us, place my father into a job and slowly begin our life in the United States.
There's this quote from an interview that you did where you said, I am the perfect example that if you give somebody a chance, especially here in the United States, one can find the way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I am forever grateful because I don't think that any place in the world I could have had this chance of you know, developing our lives. We had an opportunity to settle, to have plenty of food, to worship whatever we wanted, to speak the language that we wanted, an opportunity for education.
Right. And these are things that you can't take for granted in many parts of the world.
I don't. And that's why sometimes even today, I when I hear things, I said, oh, my God, you know, I'm afraid I'm going to lose my freedom that I found, hopefully. You know.
Yeah, it makes the presidential election very relevant to you, I suppose.
It does. It does. I'm following it. Even my mother, who's 97, she says, I was never interested in politics. I'm watching this. I'm looking at this.
That's crazy. So you started working in a restaurant or a pizzeria right after you graduated from high school because at that point you didn't know that you wanted to be a chef.
Well,
right?
No. Now let's go back just for a moment in Istria and the conditions. So my mother, who was a teacher and she had to abide by the communist rule, she put my brother and myself with my grandmother, who was in a little town, so that we would have a little bit more freedom. The grandma did take us to church now and then. And grandma grew everything because food was also scarce. We had chickens, we had ducks, we had goats, we had pigs. Well, they'd enough to feed the family. They had olives, enough olive oil for the year. My grandfather made wine. So I grew up in a setting, you know, November was time to slaughter. And
you were a locavore before there were locavores.
Yeah, I guess so. Absolutely. The country harvesting, you know, the potatoes out of the earth, the wheat, and ultimately, you know, the wheat every end of June. And then grandma and I would go to the mill to mill for the flour that she needed, when she needed it. So there was this rhythm of seasonality, of foods, of conserving, of respecting foods, of preserving foods, of making the sausages, the lard, the bacon, all of this. She all did it. And I was a little helper with her. And I think that's where my my passion for food started.
Interesting.
But you know what, Ed? Even more than that, I didn't know we were going to escape. So I didn't say goodbye to grandma or anybody. But when I realized that I wasn't going back, you know, kind of a pang took
wow.
me. You know, I said, you know, I didn't say goodbye to grandma. I didn't. And I think that from then on, food became my connection. And I used to cook all the foods that I did with grandma, all the smells and all of that. And food is memory. Food is a connector. And I had a passion for. So when we came to America, I loved cooking. I cooked at home. Mom worked late. Sometimes I cooked. But my first job, we ultimately ended up in Astoria. And my father was a mechanic and my mother was a teacher, but of course she couldn't teach. So she became a seamstress. And when I was 14, I looked for a job. And across the street from where we lived was Walken's Bakery. That's Christopher Walken's family.
That's awesome.
I was 14 and I lied. I went in there because I wanted a weekend job. I was still in high school. And I told them I was 16 and I was always a big girl. And they took me on, and I worked for 4 or 5 years in the Walken's Bakery with Christopher Walken, and we're still friends with Christopher Walken.
That's hilarious. And yeah. was it a German bakery?
Oh, it was a delicious German bakery. They made the Stollen, the Spetzels, all for the Christmas holiday. I had a great time. But you see, then I got into food.
Right.
Then, you're right, when I finished high school and I went to Hunter College. I began in pizza place like everybody else today. You know, you're a young kid. What do? You wait tables or you help.
Sure.
And so then I went into the restaurant and I always ended up kind of in the back doing something, cooking or something. So kind of I evolved in that without even planning.
Right.
But it was
following your passion.
It was. I was following what I loved doing and it didn't come hard. And it made me a little money while I was going to school. But then I met my husband who was in the restaurant business. He was also an immigrant, Felix, but he was the front of the house, as they called it. You know, he was a maitre d' in Romeo Salta and Giambelli. And
those are all old Italian restaurants, sort of midtown expense account restaurants.
Exactly.
Early.
That's very early, yeah. They were the sort of, you know, first there is the Italian-American, then there was the North Italian, and then came the regional, which at Felidia I got involved, the real
right.
regional. But those were the North Italian restaurants, as they were called. And we had Joseph, and then eventually he wanted to open a little restaurant. And, you know, I was home with Joseph. I was working part-time in restaurants still, you know. But I said, you know what? I'll help you. And in 1971, we opened, we bought a little restaurant, was 9 tables.
In Forest Hills.
In Forest Hills. And there, I wasn't a chef, you know, I was too young and not experienced. We hired an Italian-American chef. I became his sous chef. And for 10 years, I worked in the kitchen with the chef. And that's where I kind of got honed my skills. But also I realized that, you know, I needed to go back to Italy. I needed to go back to school to learn certain elements.
So you apprenticed in a restaurant that you own
right.
for 10 years.
Yes, yes.
I never knew that.
That's why, you know, if you see some of my shows and my books, the Italian-American cuisine I know well.
Right.
And I love it. And I think it's a valiant cuisine, one of immigrants.
And
coming.
You've told me the story of sneaking people things that weren't part of the Italian-American menu. Just like, here, try some risotto or whatever.
Or some polenta with venison because we had hunters that would bring us the venison. So all the things that we cooked at home, I decided, well, you know, I'm going to cook it in the restaurant. We ate it. I says, I'm going to make a little extra and give it for free.
When people ordered the spaghetti and meatballs, they also got a side order of polenta with venison.
Exactly, exactly. And then eventually when you kind of, we put it on special, and then you kind of feel it out. And so we expanded because we were busy. Then we had 2 restaurants. In 1981, we sold both restaurants and we opened Felidia. And that's where I became the chef. After 10 years.
That's a really long apprenticeship. You're very patient.
Well, you know, because, yes, I wasn't, you know, I didn't go to a old culinary school and whatever. So, I evolved, but I had a passion and I knew that I needed to learn a lot. But I knew when we opened, when we were opening Felidia, I said, here I need to cook the real Italian cuisine, what we eat at home. Americans are ready for it, and I'm going to start. And that's what really brought a lot of attention.
So Felidia was really, for all intents and purposes, an Istrian restaurant.
It was basically North Italian in the sense. Istria, Friuli Venezia Giulia, the Veneto. I knew some of the northern kind of Milanese, risotto, and all of that. But I didn't know all of Italy at that time.
Right.
I went back to Italy continuously, and I still go. You know that.
Because that's essentially you're just going back to school every time you go.
Every time. I go into restaurants, into kitchen with chefs. I have them show me, teach me. Absolutely. I go in the stores, in the big stores. I'm interested. What Italians are eating? What's happening in the markets? What is new? What is happening?
So you talked about a little bit about what food represents to you. And I read this quote also that food for you was a connecting link to your grandmother, to your childhood, to your past. And what you said, what I found out is that for everybody, food is a connector to their roots, to their past in different ways. It gives you security. It gives you a profile of who you are, where you come from. And so I think what I didn't realize until this moment is that's actually a very personal statement for you. It's not an intellectual construct.
It's my experience, which I realize that it's not only mine. It applies to all of humans, because it has such a profound effect on me. It really was magnified by the fact that I left my grandmother, that food was such a connector. But it's not only mine. Everybody feels this way about their food, about their culture, about their holidays. Food is such a connector. Besides nourishing you and being...
And delicious.
Yes. Gives you pleasure. Food can tell you, if you eat a cuisine, and you can do this for sure, Ed, and if they present a cuisine to you, you can tell almost the topography of that cuisine. You can tell the climate. Are there dry spices? Are there herbs? Is there goat's milk? Is there sheep's milk? Or is the cow's milk? Is there in the hills or is it in the mountains?
Sure, it's almost like an MRI into the soul of a country.
Exactly.
So you opened Felidia, and then you were a guest on Julia Child's television show. So let's talk about your introduction to television.
Okay. So I opened Felidia and, a lot of the press and journalists, because I started cooking things like yotta. These things are sort of a little bit off even today.
What is yotta?
Frigo. Yotta is, pasta e fagioli, but instead of the pasta... In that area, in the north, we put sauerkraut in there. So it's a delicious... You never had it?
No.
What's with
you? You've never made me yotta.
What's with you? We got to make it. That's a winter soup. Okay, we'll do it. And so people came and journalists, what is this woman cooking? Is this Italian? Is it not? And so that's how the press began. Julia Child came. With James Beard, they came. And, for me, this was big honors. But you know what? And maybe at that time, I didn't even realize. I was just delighted that people loved what I was doing and the message, But Julia Child, she came often. She began to come. Then she wanted me to teach her how to make risotto. We became friends. She came over the house. We gave her the lesson in risotto. She learned risotto. And she asked me to be on her show. And that's why we did two shows. I did two episodes, the MasterChef series. And that's where the producer says, Lydia, you're pretty good. How about a show of your own? And she encouraged me. And that's why, she was PBS. I am on PBS. That's what I love. That's where I want to be. And the way, what I realized in watching her and also in her mentoring is that when she was on that show, it was all about the people out there. She wanted those people to learn in the simplest way what she was doing. And she wanted them to do it at home with them. And I said, that's what a real show is all about. It's not about showing them how much I know as a chef, how fast I can chop, or how I can mount things. It's how can I transfer this pleasure and this knowledge to the viewer?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have proceeded in that. You know, we won Emmy Awards for our, James Beard Awards for our show. And I take great pride. But Julia Child had a lot to getting me on, and then kind of the philosophy of what I do on the
show. Right, but you're not a show woman. You're not trying to be a ringmaster. You're really trying to take people on a journey with you.
I am. I'm trying to penetrate that lens, and I know I do, because and go into their home and make them feel comfortable and make them feel sort of easy in the kitchen, easy with food, because you know well that in America there was a distance between food and people. Mm-hmm. In a sense, you know, the Industrial Revolution, the women went to work, and they delegated the cooking to big industry, and big industry took it over, and then they didn't know how to get it back.
They lost their connection to the kitchen.
So you know, I wanted, and I think they're now everybody's looking for that connection, because that's the reality.
Sure,
that's where we all should be.
What advice would you give to a young woman who is starting out in the food culture? It can be a little overwhelming to try to figure out a path.
Absolutely. If it's just a job that they need to make to support and make money, then, you know, choosing a part of the food industry that will accommodate that, whether it's a bakery, whether it's a diner, whether. But if it's a passion, then it's much more. And what I would say to women is, you know, women had difficulties in this industry because it's a tough industry.
And a very macho industry, at least it was for many years.
It is, it is. That's, you know, that's when the men took the profession, because cooking is a professional, women profession. I mean, you know, in the beginning, the men were hunters out there, and
right.
The women would be home. But then the men realized, especially, you know, after I think the French Revolution, it all happened where there was no big haute cuisine for the kings. The restaurants were born, and professions and brigades were born, and all of that. So it became, the men took it as a profession, and it remained. And women were always kind of hush that at the kitchen. But women have a grand place in the kitchen. It's a wonderful, if you have that passion, it's a wonderful opportunity for a woman. But this is what you need to do. And what I would say is, don't be afraid. Face it. Go for it. The one thing is, educate yourself. Be ready. Be ready for whatever the challenge you want to go into. You know, don't be under. Be on the par of that man. You know, whoever that chef is, you have to have the equal criteria, equal qualities. Otherwise, it doesn't work. The problem that women have is, of course, of being mothers and raising family, and that's a problem. And I had, when we opened first Bonavia in 71, Joe was already born, but my daughter was born after we opened. And I had this problem. I said, okay, so I'm a mother. I'm supposed to be home feeding the baby, but I love what I do. And I need to do it because the two of us were in business, you know. And I went to the pediatrician and I said, listen, I have a dilemma here. I feel guilty. I have a baby. I want to take care of it and give her all. But on the other hand, I'm needed where I am and I love what I do. And he was a very wise man. He looked at me and he said, Lydia, children want happy parents. You figure it out. Spend a little time here, organize yourself, who's going to take care of your child, how, and then give it the most love that you can when you can, and involve the child. The children love to be involved with what parents do.
And somehow your kids are, well, even though you didn't encourage them to go into the business, you know, Joe is Mario Batali's partner and your partner in many ventures, uh-huh. And your daughter is also involved in your business. So somehow you made it all work.
Yeah, yeah. You just kind of get yourself mentally prepared. But I think that you have to make plans. You know, I was blessed to have my mother. And, you know, in the Italian family style, you know, we all take care of each other like cats. You know, you kind of. And she was always there. She still is, as you said, 97, living with me. And so she helped me. And yes, you do accept that, you know, there were times when, you know, at 2 o'clock at night, I was coming home and then the babies were crying and I would have to stay up with the babies. And, you know, and then you kind of work it out. You know, don't make it the end of the line. Look for help. And if it gives you pleasure, you know, you'll be success at it.
Yeah.
And make it happen.
Let's talk about Italy. You know, Italy started with Oscar Farinetti.
Right.
In Turin, right?
Torino.
And when he wanted to bring the concept to America, he came and talked to you and Joe. I mean, how did that all come about?
Okay. So I, you know, as I said before, I go to Italy regularly now. But then once a year, sometimes twice a year, just to do research. And I had heard of this concept in Torino. So I went for the slow food event in Torino. Mm-hmm. And I arranged that I would visit Italy. And I called Oscar. I wanted to meet him. And we did. We talked. He showed me, and I was really impressed. Then he invited me back to do events, so I did two events there. And then we sit down, and he told me, says, Lydia, I really would like to come to New York, but I would like to come with you. By that time, I was already partnered with Joe and Mario. And so I said, you know, I'm going to talk to my boys.
Your boys.
Yeah, let's see what they
think. Your crew, Joe and Mario.
Yeah. I said, let's see what they think about it and what they say. I came back, yeah, sure, Mom. They were excited about it and whatever. And I went back and I said, yes, we're into it. We're for it. And so on. The proposal came and then we analyzed. We looked for spaces and so on.
But it's amazing what it's become because it is like, in many ways, like an Italian food festival in the confines of a store.
It is. It's, you know, the idea of it that you have almost 360 degree of food. You have the raw food and vegetable. Then you have the groceries. That's the next step. People come in, they buy the raw food, they buy the breads, everything that would make a meal. And then we have also La Scuola, the school where you can take classes in order how to cook that food. Or you have the option of going to one of the restaurants. We have seven restaurants to experience that food. You know, if you see great Long Island calamari on that in the seafood department, you will see it in the pesce restaurant on right. The menu. And so you get to taste everything. And so this was, I think it's an extraordinary opportunity experience. But not only that, within that context, you know, you have the piazza where you can have a nice antipasto. You have the salumi, the cheese, the mozzarella there, the raw bar. And you can just have a glass of wine and have a little plate of any of those. Snack, socialize, or you can sit down and have a meal. Ice cream. There's the Lavazza bar. It's like going in Italy. So it's a very Italian setting. It's like maybe 3-4 blocks of Italy in one confine.
Right.
In one confine. And people really love it. There's space, you know, you can take a glass of wine and shop around with a glass of wine. But that's a civilized way of shopping, you know.
The first Italy in New York on 23rd Street and Fifth Avenue has become one of the top 5 tourist attractions in all of New York. Did you anticipate it becoming this social thing?
No, not at all. You know, we didn't, and that's what's so great about it, that it has become a social stop, if you will. Whether you come for a coffee, let's meet at Italy for coffee. Then what happens? You go in, oh, well, let's have a bite, or let's have a pizza, or let's have... Your options are there, so diverse. And your options are to eat real Italian food and good Italian food. What I loved about Oscar's proposal was that all of the retail is based, you know, his connection with slow food. And that most of the retails are the small artisans in Italy that are part of slow food. So really unique top food products from Italy that maybe you cannot even get in Italy at sometimes because, you know, the artisans are very regional. But through slow food, the connection of Oscar with Petrini, we have that was a good... for me, a good feel because it's all about the products.
Right. You know? In a way, it's sort of your philosophy writ large. I mean, I never really thought of it before, but Italy is obviously Oscar came up with the concept, but it makes perfect sense that he came to you and that you in turn brought it to Joe and to Mario.
He's a wise man, and in a sense, you know, to recognize I think that, you know, the Italy here, we gave it also another dimension, because what we brought to the retail part, we brought a strong restaurant and prepared food element, which is because I would say that our sales are almost 50-50
between
prepared food and retail.
Interesting.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's so we brought that strong element, and you know, we brought it to what Americans would like, because that's what our specialty is.
Sure.
Americans love Italy, you know that. Italian food is the number one ethnic food. And this just proved the point.
Yeah, it's true. So there are two Italy's in New York. There's one in Chicago. There are two more on the way.
There's Boston coming up now in November.
And then L.A.
And Vegas.
And Vegas.
And we have one in São Paulo.
And São Paulo.
Now, Italy...
Italy itself, Oscar also has places in
exactly
all over the world.
Our connection is in the Americas.
Got it.
We are connected, and we just signed a contract with Toronto.
Toronto. So now you have Toronto, São Paulo.
Well, Toronto is going to take another two. So the operating ones are the two New York, the downtown World Trade Center, four World Trade Center, and 23rd Street and 5th. And Chicago is the operating, and the São Paulo is operating. The other ones are opening.
Got it.
Next, Boston, and then Vegas, and L.A., and Toronto.
It's good, because you don't have enough to do. So I think you should open, you know, I don't want you to get bored, Lydia.
You know, you can get into mischief if you're bored.
So whenever I talk to you, I always want to ask you this question, which has to do with the name of the show. What is your special sauce?
You know... the one thing that I am, that I guard in all of that I do is the loyalty that I have of my customers. Through the years, I have developed such a loyalty with the customer. They trust me. And it's, for me, God forbid, I should not deliver what I promised them.
You would never violate that trust.
I would never, because I know then that's, I'm not keeping up my end of the deal.
Yeah.
And so trust is when they came in the restaurant, slowly the trust built, they continued to come. And, you know, it's not easy, but within all of our restaurants, you know, with all the chefs, this philosophy, it's almost a philosophy of thinking about goes, and it's important that when I do my television, you know, they need to trust me that they're going to make that recipe, that it's going to work, that I'm going to, you know, test it and retest it.
Trust is such a big thing with Serious Eats, too. It's why I think people have come to trust things that they read on Serious Eats. And I never really thought of it in quite this way. But it's really the most important attribute.
It is. You can violate that, because then there is no relationship. You know, at least I feel that way. So when you're talking about my sauces, you know, for the people that come, that can't spend and come into my restaurant, very much appreciate, buy my books. But there's people out there that will never move out of there. They watch my television. They see me. And, you know, I thought giving them a Lydia flavor in sauces and pasta would just bring Lydia to them. And they can, but again...
They can access
it. Exactly. And, you know, in business, you cannot say in business with just ideology. You have to have a business plan. And it has to work, you know, because if it doesn't work, nothing happens. So the production of whether it's the book, the show, the restaurant, or the sauces has to have a good business plan. It has to be a good exchange, in a sense, you know, the business has to make money so it can continue, survive, and grow. And the people have to get their money's worth.
Right. And that's where the trust comes in.
Exactly.
Got it. So now it's time for the special sauce, All You Can Answer Buffet. No, you know, we don't have a song. We're not going to speed you along like Jeopardy. But so what's in your desert island fridge? You're marooned on a desert island. You can have anything flown in, and you have a refrigerator with power.
Ah. Oh, my goodness. Well, I certainly need the basics. I need some garlic, some onions, some olive oil. I need some grana padano. I need some eggs, flour, and then the fresh herbs. It just keeps on going. Vegetables, I love vegetables. I mean, I like seasonality.
So you need a really big desert island fridge.
Well, I, you know, how long am I going to stay there?
it's indeterminate. It's not. It's not
I, if you give me a fish and reel, if you give me a fish and reel, maybe I can get the proteins out of the sea.
All right.
I don't mind. And if there's a little garden, I can grow a little tomatoes with the seeds, so I can continue my garden. But yeah, I need the vegetables. I need the condiments like olive oil. I need some good cheeses and pasta, of course. Flour to make some fresh pasta. You know, just keeps on going.
All right. So this is going to be a really tough question for you. Who's at your Last Supper, no family allowed? See, the no family allowed, I know, makes it this a really difficult question for you because you're so rooted in your family. But you could have anybody who you've always wanted to break bread with.
Oh, my goodness. That's nice. Well, I love music. I mean, I love the operas, so Verdi would be fine.
Verdi, okay.
Yeah, Verdi. I think Tchaikovsky, too. I love
Tchaikovsky him. And yeah. Verdi. This is a very high-minded table.
No, it's just, you know, I always wondered about Dostoevsky's book and his philosophy. I would have questions to ask him, you know.
He's got some splaining to do?
Yes, he does. Two more people.
Yeah.
Caravaggio. He also has explaining to do. I would feed them food, and I want to know what the real truth is. But then let's get more contemporary. I don't know, you know. I just cooked for Sophia Loren in the... I was in California. I just love that woman. I think she... You know, when I was young, I used to watch her, and she was such an epitome of an Italian woman, sure of herself, you know, nothing.
Yes, way ahead of her time in her own way.
I think Sophia, who else?
That's good. Sophia Loren, Caravaggio, Tchaikovsky.
Dostoevsky,
and Verdi.
Verdi.
I think you're good.
I think
I think that's an awesome table. I want
to
come.
I think I would like Julia, too, to help me.
Okay.
To help me out.
To help you out, Julia Child. Perfect. And what are you eating?
Oh, well,
so give me a three-course menu.
A three-course menu. Okay. So, you know, I think these are all different periods here. So I would make a nice, good capon soup with tortellini.
Capon soup with tortellini. Tortellini and brodo, really.
Tortellini and brodo, but in capon soup like the old-fashioned. Then, you know, I happen to love... Maybe I would begin with beautiful figs off the tree, like I remember I used to get, and some nice slices of prosciutto.
Okay.
Then capon soup and tortellini. And then some grilled fish... You know,
simple grilled fish.
Grilled fish with a beautiful green salad, tossed. You know, simple.
Simple,
good
perfect.
Crunchy bread. And then a beautiful tart. Fruit tart, whatever fruit is in season.
Wow.
Yeah?
That sounds so Lydia. I mean, that's the perfect meal. So what's your guilty pleasure? Like, what would you say that you love that people would go, Lydia Bastianich loves blank?
You know, I like all the ones like everybody, and, you know, whether it be a nice hamburger or even a frankfurter or something like that. But sometimes when I come home and, you know, I haven't eaten in the restaurant, you leave all this food in the restaurant, but sometimes you just don't eat. You just go home and I'm hungry for something. A nice peanut butter and jelly sandwich with a glass of milk and grape jelly.
I'm with you.
And I like the peanut butter to have a little crunch in there, to have
Got
a little
it. So it has to be crunchy, not creamy.
Right. And I like a whole wheat toast.
All right.
Is that
I
okay?
like this.
You like this?
I like this.
Okay.
I like this. I share that, by the way.
Oh.
Sometimes I even eat the peanut butter with a spoon.
You know, when I don't want to eat too much, but I put a little bit of jam on that spoon, too.
Yeah, me too.
Oh,
shh,
okay.
Don't tell my wife.
All right.
So what do you cook when there's nothing in the house to eat?
Oh, you got to go to pasta. Spaghetti, garlic, and oil.
Okay, that's
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. I love that. This could be, you could give me the same answer, but I wish you would give me a different answer. If you could have a one-on-one lunch with any person, living or dead, just because spending 2 hours with that person and that person alone would be so fascinating to you. Who would it be?
And again, family doesn't.
Yeah.
You know who I would like to kind of analyze? Dante.
Dante.
I want to analyze his inferno with him.
I love that. These are awesome answers. Well, thank you, Lydia Bastianich, for sharing your special sauce with us. It's such a pleasure to have you here, and we've known each other so long, and it's really been my treat to have you on.
Thanks for inviting me.
And go to Eataly's all over the world, in New York and Chicago, soon to be in Boston and L.A. Watch Lydia on her television shows. Read how many books? I think I added them up. You've written 14 books, including two children's books.
Three children's books. Yeah, so it's 11 and then three children's books.
Wow, that's incredible. You're
on target.
You're amazing, and we'll see you next time, Sirius Eaters. And thank you so much, Lydia Bastianich.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks for having me.